From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the secret deals that were made or nearly made during the impeachment and trial of President Bill Clinton, deals that reflect how government really works. We talk with Peter Baker about his new book, The Breach. He covered the impeachment for The Washington Post. After the Senate trial, he conducted hundreds of further interviews and got access to documents that hadn't been made public. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the debut CD by jazz clarinetist Andy Biskin. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Island of Lost Maps, a true crime story about the world of antiquarian map collecting. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Food and Drug Administration has approved the drug that's come to be known as the abortion pill, RU486, for use in the United States. We have two reports, the first from Patricia Nament.
Proponents of RU486 hope FDA approval will expand access to abortion. Abortion services are available in only 14% of all U.S. counties. In recent physician surveys, one-third of all family doctors and gynecologists who do not now perform surgical abortion say they would consider prescribing RU486. Under new FDA guidelines, most physicians can prescribe the drug, but if the medical abortion does not work, they must be able to perform a surgical abortion or refer patients to a doctor who will. The Planned Parenthood Federation of America says 125 of its clinics across the country are ready to offer Mifeprex. The drug's manufacturer says it should be on the market within 1 month. Patricia Nament, NPR News.
This is Peter Kenyon with the Bush campaign in Wisconsin. The Republican presidential candidate says the FDA was wrong to grant approval to the abortion bill RU486. In a statement, Bush said people on both sides of the abortion issue can agree that we should do everything that we can to reduce the number of abortions. Bush said he fears that making the abortion pill widespread will make abortions more and more common rather than more and more rare. President Clinton said the government's approval of the pill was made purely on the basis of science and medicine. Mr. Clinton also accused Republicans of trying to politicize the issue. The FDA approval means limited American use of the drug will be allowed. The decision follows a strong campaign against approval by opponents of abortion rights. The group Concerned Women for America called RU486 dangerous to women. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Green Bay, Wisconsin.
A federal grand jury in Texas has indicted Koch Industries, the giant oil pipeline company, on charges of violating environmental laws. The indictment charges Koch, a subsidiary, and four employees with violations at its Corpus Christi plant that intentionally allowed large amounts of untreated benzene fumes to vent into the atmosphere. Benzene, considered a hazardous air pollutant, has been linked to cancer. Company officials say Koch voluntarily disclosed the problems to Texas environmental officials in 1995 and quickly took steps to get into compliance. Former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau has died. He was 80. The flamboyant Trudeau was a political celebrity who championed a strong central government and opposed Quebec separatism.
Canada must be one. Canada must be progressive. And Canada must be a just society.
Trudeau became prime minister in 1968 and held on to power for most of the next 16 years. In stocks today, the Dow gained 196 points to close at 10,824. This is NPR News. Exit polls in Denmark today show that the Danes apparently voted not to adopt the euro, the European Union's single currency. Polls generally showed that voters rejected the euro by 53% to 47%. Federal prosecutors in Boston have indicted two alleged organized crime figures for murder. The two men were also FBI informants. Fred Tice reports from member station WBUR in Boston.
Federal authorities first prosecuted James Whitey Bulger and his associate Stephen Flemmie for racketeering 5 years ago. Bulger has been a fugitive since then. This is the first time that murder charges are being brought against Bulger, Boston's most notorious organized crime figure. U.S. Attorney Donald Stern calls the indictments perhaps the most important step in his pursuit of the two reputed mobsters.
The victims include strangers who happen to be in the, quote, wrong place, longtime criminal associates, friends, and others whom they believed might provide information to law enforcement or could otherwise threaten their organization.
Some of the murders took place while Bulger and Flemmy were protected FBI informants. For NPR News, I'm Fred Tice in Boston.
The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries ended its summit in Caracas today with a statement saying that high oil prices are the result of excessive taxation by the industrialized nations. OPEC said it was up to governments in the consuming countries to cut taxes on petroleum products and ease the cost to citizens. The statement pledged that OPEC members would try to keep the market steady by supplying oil at fair and stable prices. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Peter Baker's new book, The Breach, is about the impeachment of President Clinton, but it isn't about cigars and thongs. It's about the secret deals that were made or nearly made behind the scenes involving all three branches of government. Baker covered the impeachment for The Washington Post. After the end of the Senate trial, he conducted about 350 related interviews and read thousands of pages of documents that had never been made public. I asked him if his understanding of the impeachment changed after the research he conducted for the book.
I think I understood a little bit more that it wasn't inevitable. I think in hindsight, we all look back at it and think, oh, you know, the House was always going to impeach, and the Senate was always going to acquit, and it would always turn out to be the way it did. But in fact, when you go back and talk to the people involved, you recognize that there were any number of pivot points, any number of very important junctures at which this could have turned out very differently. History would have been a very different story if at any of these critical moments people had made decisions differently. And I thought that was important.
Let's look at some of those critical points at which the story could have taken a completely different turn. For example, Bob Livingston, who was the House Speaker, wanted to go for censure. He was thinking of censure and not impeachment. Why was there a moment when he was thinking about censure?
Bob Livingston, who of course had dethroned Newt Gingrich after the 1998 elections, struggled with this, I think, from the beginning. Initially, after the elections, he told Dick Gephardt, the House minority leader, that he was open to censure as an option. But Tom DeLay, who was the real power at that point in the Republican caucus, kept convincing him, kept talking to him why censure was a bad idea and they shouldn't allow it. And he came around to that view himself, and he said he wouldn't allow censure. But then on the day the impeachment debate opened in the House, the day it went to the floor of the House in December of 1998, Livingston was back in a cloakroom off the floor, and he just had a moment of doubt. He suddenly said to an aide, "This is craziness. This must stop." And he told the aide to convene a meeting because they were going to have a censure vote instead of impeachment. And the aide, who had just learned about the secret Juanita Broderick evidence, which is the allegation of sexual assault against the president, told Livingston he couldn't do it. He said, "Bob, you can't. There's a rapist in the White House." And they talked about it, and Livingston agreed that that Clinton was guilty of impeachable crimes and should be impeached, and his resolve was strengthened. But it came that close to calling off impeachment.
On the other hand, there was a moment when Dick Gephardt, the House Democratic leader, was considering asking Clinton to resign if an impeachable offense was found.
Yeah, the congressional Democrats liked Clinton only slightly more than the congressional Republicans. And so in August and September of 1998, when the president first admitted that he had misled the nation and he went to the grand jury and the Star report was coming out, Gephardt was very much holding his own counsel. He was very much not certain which way he would go on this. And he told the chief Democratic investigator who was going to be looking at the evidence that he needed to let him know what was really in there, because if it came down to it, he would have to go to the White House and tell Clinton to resign.
Now, what about Henry Hyde? Anything he was considering doing differently, the head of the House Judiciary Committee?
Henry Hyde, of course, was the head of the Judiciary Committee, the lead manager, and once it got to the Senate trial. And he was always the public face of impeachment. He was sort of the lead crusader, if you will, and he very much believed in that cause. But in a private moment, throughout. In fact, he doubted whether they would actually succeed. He's a longtime congressman, and he's a pragmatist. He understands vote counting, and he knew he didn't have the votes in the Senate, most likely. And so privately, he was conducting secret negotiations with the White House through intermediaries and then eventually directly, in which he was trying to find a back-channel compromise. These are meetings that were so clandestine at the time that people didn't even tell their own aides about them. And Hyde proposed a rather amazing deal. He proposed that if Clinton accepted impeachment, if he stopped fighting impeachment in the House, then Hyde would make sure it didn't go to trial in the Senate. He would work out a deal with Trent Lott, and the president would be censured, and then it would be over. And the White House, of course, couldn't accept impeachment, couldn't sort of lay down and simply roll over on that, and so they rejected the deal.
Now, what did President Clinton almost do differently?
Well, you know, things would have been different for him had Democrats early on in August and September of 98 abandoned him. You know, he survived through this whole thing with sort of a gritty determination never to resign. But in part, that was founded on the premise that his own party would stick with him. It was never the Republicans who could force Clinton from office. It was always the Democrats, in the same way that it was Barry Goldwater and fellow Republicans who forced Richard Nixon from office. And the White House knew this. But in August of 1998, President Clinton's position was far more precarious than we really understood with his own fellow Democrats. Gephardt, as we talked about, was actively considering whether he might have to go to the White House and tell Clinton to resign. He had his staff do a count of how many House Democrats might vote for impeachment at that point. And the staff came up with 100 names, 100 out of a 206-member caucus were possible pro-impeachment votes at that point. Tom Daschle, the top Democrat in the Senate, he wouldn't even take the president's calls. He was so angry. Harold Ickes, a former top aide to the president, really the mastermind of his 1996 reelection, was going around town secretly talking to important Democrats and labor leaders about whether they should come to a point of having to go to the president and urge him to resign. So really, it was very close to the edge, and the White House people were convinced that had one or two important, prominent Democrats come out for resignation, that it would have started a stampede, and the president never would have been able to survive.
Now, these examples that you're giving us about what happened behind the scenes, do you think they show how polarized Congress was during impeachment, or how close Congress came to cutting a deal?
Well, I think it was a very polarized situation, and it was very partisan, and it was very partisan on both sides. You know, a lot of the discussion about how Congress handled this focused on Republican partisanship, and it was certainly there. But the Democrats also used partisanship as a weapon, as a shield for the president in a very deliberate way. Once Gephardt decided that he would stick with Clinton, once he decided that the Starr report hadn't damaged the president's public standing to the point where he couldn't survive, he formulated a strategy that would, along with other Democrats, that essentially manufactured partisanship in order to delegitimize the process. In other words, have as many partisan votes as they could over however many issues they could find, because the more partisan it was, the more of a food fight it seemed to the general public, and it would never be seen as credible.
Well, Dick Gephardt also came up with, as you describe it, a kind of complicated censure compromise.
He did, yeah. He had he did come around to the president's defense, but he also was legitimately angry at the president and thought that he had done things that were worthy of punishment. And he came up with his own secret censure plan. It would not only censure the president, reprimand him, if you will, for what he had done, but would also take away his pension for 5 years. And that would have cost the president $750,000 over 5 years. And it also would have imposed reforms on the way the president had, in Gephardt's view, misused executive privilege and the use of the White House counsel's office basically as a personal defense team for him. But the plan actually went nowhere, and the reason why, again, was not the Republicans. It was the fellow Democrats. Hillary Clinton, who had been the family's main breadwinner for all these years, all of the savings of the Clinton family essentially are hers, didn't want to sacrifice $750,000 for this. And the House Democrats, other members of Congress, said, "Whoa, wait a second! You're going to take some. You're going to take a politician's pension away for bad behavior. This is a precedent they didn't want to see happen."
Now, the story from the book that has made the most news is what you call David Kendall's longest walk.
Yes, that's right.
David Kendall is the president's lawyer who represented him. You know, one of the lawyers who represented him during impeachment. Describe what happened. What this walk was about.
Well, in August of 1998, of course, Ken Starr came up with the blue dress from Monica Lewinsky and the DNA evidence that was inevitably going to prove that the president had had a sexual affair with Monica Lewinsky, and he had to go to the grand jury and testify about it. Well, a few days before he went to the grand jury, he realized a story was about to come out, and he had to make sure that somebody talked to Hillary Clinton. And he didn't want to be the one to talk to Hillary Clinton, at least not at first. And so the person who went and broke the news to her that the president was going to change his story to the grand jury and then admit to the nation that he had had a sexual affair with Monica Lewinsky, the person who was charged with doing that was David Kendall, his lawyer. And in some ways, if the president wasn't going to do it himself, Kendall was sort of an obvious emissary. He not only had attorney-client privilege, but he also had represented Mrs. Clinton for many years through Whitewater, and the two were very close. He was a confidant of hers, and she trusts him like very few other people. And so he did have to take what had to have been the longest walk of his career and over to the east wing of the White House to explain to the First Lady of the United States that her husband, in fact, was going to tell the nation that he had been with another woman.
My guest is Washington Post reporter Peter Baker. His new book about the impeachment is called The Breach. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Washington Post reporter Peter Baker, and his new book, The Breach, is about what happened politically behind the scenes during the impeachment process. And Baker covered the impeachment process for The Washington Post. Let's talk a little bit about the debates in the White House about when and what Clinton should say to the American public at about the time of the grand jury appearance, you know, regarding his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. You say that Mickey Cantor, the former Commerce Secretary, who was still occasionally advising the president on damage control, he advocated having Clinton preempt Starr by addressing the nation the night before the grand jury appearance. But his lawyers were horrified. Talk a little bit about that disagreement.
Well, that was part of this rather extraordinary few days when the White House was consumed with how to handle this, how to get on top of it. They all knew the president had to change his story at that point. And however much they wanted to believe he had been telling the truth, they all knew that he hadn't been at that point. And so they thought maybe it would be a good idea, Mickey Cantor thought maybe it would be a good idea to sort of one-up Kenneth Starr by admitting it to the country first. But lawyers don't like that kind of thing. Defense lawyers like David Kendall want to be able to control how their client testifies and the statements that he makes and to do it in a legal setting as much as possible. So that was never something that they wanted to do. And there was a big discussion, a big fight, really, after the grand jury testimony that Monday, August 17th, 1998, as to what the president should say to the nation on television. How much should he be contrite? Should he mention Ken Starr? Should he express his own bitterness? And in fact, most of his political advisors told him not to. Stick to the apology. Don't say anything about Ken Starr. Don't talk about how you don't think this is fair. But the president rejected their advice, and he was egged on by some of his more hardline advisors, like Mickey Cantor, Sidney Blumenthal, and even his wife. And he ended up, of course, giving a speech that bristled with defiance and resentment and bitterness, and sort of took away from the message of contrition that most of his staff thought he should be delivering.
Now, there were other drafts written by staff and supporters. What were those other drafts like? Did you see them?
Yeah, some of them were much more contrite. They received one from Bob Schrum, the old Kennedy wordsmith, who was so contrite to the point they felt even the staff who thought Clinton should be more apologetic, they thought that draft went overboard. It was too abject. It would weaken him and so forth. So there are several variations of a theme at work, lots of paper all around, and then, of course, the president's own hand-scrawled version as he sat there in the solarium of the White House scribbling on a piece of paper, literally writing it minutes before the speech.
So President Clinton really did write that speech himself.
He wrote a lot. I mean, it really was his speech. I mean, he took things other people wrote, and he adjusted, and he rewrote, and he redrafted. You know, a lot of his aides say that we, the public, and the media complain that he's so scripted. They say, well, look at this speech. This was what he really thinks. This was not scripted by his staff. This is exactly what the president really feels in his heart. So good or bad, that was a true representation of his honest emotion.
Now, you say that when Kenneth Starr's office decided to videotape the president's testimony, that Clinton and his staff were pretty confident that this would eventually be seen by the public. So they played it with the assumption that everything that the president said would be seen and heard by
right.
the public. How was he prepped before that videotaped questioning?
They had David Kendall and Cole Seligman and his other lawyers had worked with the president to come up with what were called set pieces. They came up with 14 sort of mini speeches that he could give before the grand jury that would sort of present his point of view and his interpretation of events. In effect, he was filibustering. They would ask him some question, and then he would use that as an opportunity to get across the point that he wanted to make, whether it was really directly related to the question or not. And they knew that Starr had agreed to a strict four-hour time limit. And so the more the president talked, they figure, in these set pieces, the more he would control the interview and the more he would present his side and what they were certain was going to be shown to the general public eventually. And, of course, they were right.
What's an example of one of those set speeches?
Well, I think he just wanted to portray things in his own light. He had a written statement that he read at the beginning in which he used careful language as to how he admitted having relations with Monica Lewinsky without actually using the words. He never wanted to use words like, you know, oral sex or anything else more explicit like that. And he refused to be drawn into the discussion of specific acts because he knew, again, it would sort of, you know, if you had a president using very explicit language like that on a videotape that was sure to be shown in public, that would become the defining image of his presidency. As it was, of course, it may be a defining image, but at least he wasn't saying words that would be sort of recorded forever as a sort of embarrassing moment.
So he stuck more to terms like inappropriate behavior or inappropriate
behavior.
Sexual banter.
Right, exactly. He wouldn't use, exactly, good example, he wouldn't use terms like phone sex or things like that. How humiliating it would be for him to be known for decades and centuries to come as the president, you know, with the soundbite of those kind of words coming from his mouth.
Now, you write that House Majority Whip Tom DeLay started a war room for the impeachment. What happened in this war room?
Well, they did all sorts of things. They tried to create an environment in which it was harder for Republicans to vote against impeachment than for it. Every day they would send out messages and memos and so forth to all the different Republican congressmen. They would send out blast faxes to conservative radio talk shows around the country. They would collect the names of Republican congressmen who would call for resignation and then try to serve as sort of a booking agency with media outlets to get these people on the air. They talked with Republican leaders and activists in congressmen's districts to sort of stir up as much support for impeachment as they could. They researched things in the National Archives, including Hillary Clinton's involvement as a young lawyer for the Watergate impeachment effort. And when push came to shove, when it got close down to the wire and Henry Hyde had allowed a censure resolution to be voted on in the committee, Tom DeLay did what he could to keep it from ever being allowed on the floor. And an aide went around writing letters in the name of Henry Hyde and Bob Livingston and Newt Gingrich that effectively closed off censure as an option, and then went around getting signatures on these letters. And they were all put out, in effect, by DeLay, but his name was never on any of them. So he was sort of orchestrating the effort at every single step along the way to the point he could in order to create this environment.
Why wouldn't he have wanted his name on that letter?
Well, because it wasn't his letter to write. Formally, it was up to the Speaker of the House to make a decision on that. And I think that, that he recognized he could be only so public and only so prominent in his leadership of impeachment that he was becoming something of a boogeyman to Democrats. He was an easy target. If he was too public about it, then they would make him the issue and not Clinton. And so he tried to be both public but also private, also subtle in the way he did things. People talked at the time, oh, well, Tom DeLay must be breaking arms of congressmen. Well, he was smarter than that, actually, more clever than that, at least. When one congressman, for instance, was wavering and the word got back to DeLay, DeLay didn't call him himself to say, hey, vote for impeachment. Instead, he tracked down a conservative rabbi who knew this congressman and said, hey, you call him and see if you can talk him into impeachment. And that rabbi did call him, and in fact, that congressman did vote for impeachment.
Peter Baker is a reporter for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Breach. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Vintage Books Division, paperback publishers of Plainsong, the new novel by Kent Haroff. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the debut CD by clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. We're listening to it now. Maureen Corrigan reviews the new true crime book, The Island of Lost Maps. And we continue our talk on the politics of impeachment and hear about the repercussions of Larry Flynt's investigation into the private lives of congressmen. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Baker of The Washington Post. He covered the impeachment of President Clinton. When the Senate trial was over, Baker conducted hundreds of further interviews and got access to documents that hadn't been made public. His new book about what went on behind the scenes during the impeachment is called The Breach. One of the little dramas during the impeachment process was the Larry Flynt story. And he threatened to expose several congressmen who he never really said anything public about.
Yeah.
But you say that the investigative work that he was doing behind the scenes still had its repercussions.
Well, there was a real atmosphere of fear among congressmen, particularly Republicans. Just the fact of Larry Flynt out there was terrifying to them. He had put an ad in the Washington Post, I hate to say, for advertising $1 million bounty, if you will, to people who came forward with stories of sexual indiscretions by congressmen and other high officials. And what had happened through the fall was several congressmen had their own private misdeeds exposed, including Henry Hyde. And so a number of the managers, the people who would prosecute the president in a Senate trial, were convinced that they were the next target. One congressman got phone calls to his office threatening to out him as gay, even though he says he of course is not. But the fact that he's conservative and from a southern district, just the whisper of that would be damaging. Another congressman feared that he was on the list, and so he had sort of a cleansing conversation with his wife in which he sort of admitted all the things that maybe she wouldn't have liked to have known, just so she wouldn't hear about them from anybody else. And, of course, it turned out he wasn't actually on Larry Flynt's list. So there was a real atmosphere of fear that these people were living through at the time.
How'd you feel about your newspaper, The Washington Post, printing that advertisement that Larry Flynt took out, looking for people who were willing to confess secret affairs that they'd had with adulterous congressmen?
Well, you know, obviously that's our ad policy is that we accept ads, and that's what the newspaper does. But, you know, given our druthers, maybe we wouldn't have liked to have seen that in there. But the paper's policy is to accept ads from people even if we don't agree with them.
What kind of response did you get to those ads when you were going about your business reporting on the impeachment?
I think most people recognize that it wasn't a Washington Post effort, that it wasn't about what the Washington Post was doing, that it was what Larry Flynt had done, and that we were just simply the vehicle that he paid to advertise in. So nobody, I don't think, people weren't holding against the Post, thank goodness. But again, people were very angry about it, and they— You know, the Republicans suspected that Larry Flynt was sort of working in cahoots with the White House, and I don't know that there's any evidence of that, but it certainly fostered an atmosphere of suspicion and mistrust.
Now, you say that for this book, after the impeachment, you read thousands of documents that were never made public. What were among the most interesting things that you got to see?
Well, some people shared their diaries with me. Some people shared some of the investigative files, their internal memos over strategy. Both the Democrats and the Republicans wrote out memos summarizing some of the secret evidence that was in Ken Starr's office that he never sent over, and it was filled with rather sensational and lurid stories about the president, most of them presumably unsubstantiated, but certainly very tabloid-esque. People literally let me go through their file cabinets because I think they understood that this was a seminal moment in history and that it was important to record it as much as possible for posterity.
So what role did those secret stories about the president, those tabloid-esque stories that Kenneth Starr had that were unsupported, what role did those stories play during the impeachment, do you think?
Well, some of them, I think, helped strengthen the resolve of congressmen who weren't quite sure what to do. Quite a number of them actually went to see the Juanita Broderick evidence, which we all know about now, prior to the vote. And, you know, a number of them were probably leaning to vote for impeachment anyway, but certainly afterwards, I think they came away with a sense of revulsion at the president and also a fear that they couldn't let this go sort of unaddressed, even if Juanita Broderick and instances like that were not formally part of the charges or the articles of impeachment in front of them.
Was it legit for Kenneth Starr to show this unsubstantiated information to congressmen?
Well, that wasn't Starr's fault. I mean, he was told, he was asked to show them everything. I mean, both Democrats and Republicans kept showering him with letters saying, show us what you haven't shown us, show us what you haven't given us. And he simply complied with their wishes. So he let them into his vault to look around and to record what they saw as being relevant.
Now, you say at the end of your book that this book is not going to have a lot of footnotes because you can't reveal most of your sources. What kind of confidentiality did your sources want in talking to you about the impeachment and the secret deals behind the scenes?
Well, unfortunately, it's part of the culture in Washington right now in which people don't speak on the record as often as we think they should, as I think that they should. And the problem was that a number of people did speak to me freely and happily on the record, but enough others didn't that if you start getting to a game of who did and who didn't, you start identifying the ones who requested confidentiality. And so from my perspective, it was more important to try to get the full story and then corroborate it as much as possible, and that's what I try to do. Most of the conversations we have in the book are based not merely on people's recollections, but often in many cases on notes that were taken in meetings, memos that recorded the conversations that were going on, anything we could to try to substantiate, corroborate, double-check, and confirm.
My guest is Washington Post reporter Peter Baker. His new book about the impeachment is called The Breach. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Peter Baker is my guest, reporter for The Washington Post. His new book, The Breach, is about what happened behind the scenes, in secret, in the political process during the impeachment. During the impeachment process, when you were covering the story for The Washington Post, did either side, the Democrats or the Republicans, or Kenneth Starr's office, ever approach you with leaks?
Well, leaks are part and parcel of the trade in Washington. It's part of how we do business. But, you know, I think there is a misimpression in general among the public that stories are almost always generated by leaks, that reporters and somehow are merely passive vessels who wait for our phone call every day from Deep Throat 1 or Deep Throat 2 passing along some scurrilous thing that we simply transmit into the paper without scrutiny. And it really doesn't work that way. It's a much more complicated situation in which reporters hear things, get tips, check things out. We go to one source and we ask them about this, and they only tell you a tiny little bit, and then you go to the next person and use the little bit of information you got from the first one to try to get a little bit more out of the second one, and then you take those two bits of information, you go to the third guy, and so forth and so on. And so it's rarely as simple or clear-cut as I think the public often sees it.
Are there ever times when you feel like you're being used as the reporter with a leak and that the leak is really about a self-serving reason that the source has for wanting you to print it?
Well, very few people talk to reporters without being self-serving. I mean, it's, you know, we talk to reporters because we want to get our side out, if nothing else, even if there's nothing particularly venal about it. And a good reporter just factors that in and tries to screen out what seems to be, you know, purely self-interest and whittle it down to actual facts as much as possible, to truth as much as possible. And, of course, we're always constantly balancing those things. You talk to enough people on enough sides, and hopefully, you know, the sum total of the information you're being given, albeit each piece born out of somebody's self-interest, the sum total of it hopefully adds up to a fuller and more complete and more accurate picture.
Last week, The independent prosecutor, Robert Ray, ended the Whitewater investigation saying he'd concluded there was insufficient evidence to show that either Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton committed any crimes in connection with the Whitewater venture. But Robert Ray said he was still deciding whether to indict President Clinton after he leaves office over his sworn statement in connection with his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. What do you think still faces the president now?
Well, you know, we talk about impeachment, but the president has already, since then, he has paid an $850,000 settlement to Paula Jones. He was found in contempt of court by a federal judge in Arkansas and fined another $90,000. And he faces a bar association complaint to take away his law license in Arkansas. All of this before Robert Ray even makes his decision. And all of these things may play into Ray's decision as to whether to indict following the president leaving office. But I think that Ray has an awfully tough road ahead of him if he really plans to try to indict him, because he has to find a grand jury that will indict him. That may be easier than, but then he has to find a regular jury to convict him. And that has to factor into any prosecutor's decision. And finding 12 people in this country right now who would be open to the idea of conviction, all 12 of them, I think would be tough. People think it's been 2 years and are ready to move on, and whether they think he was guilty of the crimes or not, it might be hard to get a unanimous verdict from a jury.
Have you been following the Hillary Clinton, Rick Lazio Senate campaign?
Who hasn't been? It's a great race.
Did you feel like the impeachment story is still playing out in some way in that race?
Well, I mean, of course, in some ways it does. You know, this race was born out of impeachment. The very day in February of 1999 that the Senate was taking its final vote on whether to convict or acquit the president, Hillary Clinton was at the White House meeting with Harold Ickes discussing her prospective Senate race. So literally the day that they were passing judgment on her husband, she was trying to figure out how to join them. And her popularity, of course, that enabled this rather extraordinary campaign to be mounted in the first place was generated out of sort of a public reappraisal of her that came about as a result of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And so today it's still playing out, and I think that it both helps and hurts her. There are a number of New Yorkers who I know who are seem to be Democrats, seem to be normally people who would support her, and yet are really angry still with her, don't see why she acted in the way she did. And so the fact that it's even a race in a state that's so heavily Democratic and that Al Gore will clearly most likely win by a substantial margin, the fact that Mrs. Clinton has still has a competitive race, I think, is partly a result of the ambivalence the public has following all of these actions in 1998 and 1999.
Your book is so much about the polarization of Congress today. In January, you leave Washington to go to Moscow, where you'll report for The Washington Post. Did you say to your editors, get me out of here, I've covered American politics too long?
Well, politics there is a little simpler. If they don't like what you say about them, they simply throw you in jail.
Right.
But no, it was a great opportunity for my wife and me. My wife, Susan Glasser, works at The Washington Post as well, and we both had a longtime interest in Russia and thought this was a good time of our lives to go explore a different place. And it will be a contrast to Washington, where we've spent an awful lot of years.
Well, good luck to you when you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Peter Baker's new book about the impeachment of President Clinton is called The Breach. Baker will become Washington Post Moscow bureau chief in January. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some great music to introduce us to. After the swing era of the 1930s, the jazz clarinet seemed in danger of extinction. But lately there's been a major resurgence of interest in the instrument. Kevin says one clarinetist worth watching is Andy Biskin, as much for his composing as his playing. Born in Texas, Biskin lives in New York, where he worked for a time as an assistant to folklorist Alan Lomax. In the 1990s, Biskin started a couple of bands, both heard on his new CD. but he started on the road to being a leader when he was 15 and came across some old sheet music at a store in his native San Antonio. Kevin reviews Biskin's debut CD.
Clarinetist Andy Biskin got his initial inspiration as composer and bandleader from old arrangements for small wind bands he'd stumbled on as a teenager back in Texas. Some of those charts date from the 1930s. That may be why his pieces recall early jazz and old social music in various ways. Short solos alternate with tightly arranged passages. The rhythm section plays two-beat oompah rhythms once in a while, and his quintet has a trumpet, clarinet, and trombone front line like an old New Orleans jazz band. Even so, the sound he gets from those old ingredients is quite fresh. You can't pin his music down to any one period or style. Andy Biskin's compositions tend to be light in tone, even a bit frothy at times, but they have real substance. His tunes often have a transparent logic, as if he was still working through the basics he'd picked up from those old music books. One favorite ploy is to take a riff, expand or contract it in time, and then extend it into a longer line. He grows a whole tune from a small seed. That's Andy Biskin's tune, Table Manners. It's from his new CD, Dog Mental, on the GM label. Biskin is a good clarinet player, too, with a full and liquid tone and a knack for nimble phrasing. His style is appropriately slippery, in keeping with the way he writes. Biskin's CD mostly features his quintet with trumpeter Ron Horton, bassist Ben Allison, and drummer Matt Wilson, all fine players. There are also a few tracks by his earlier quartet, recorded in 1996. Both bands include trombonist Bruce Idem. In New York, he works a lot in big bands and Broadway shows, but he's a strong soloist too. Idem really brings out the blues feeling latent in some of this music. Thank you. Andy Biskin's quartet and quintet both favor a spare, open texture that comes from not having a piano on board. The downside is, Biskin the composer can be a bit too fond of two-chord bass vamps to anchor the blowing. Still, that's a minor beef compared to what he's accomplished, making modern music using old ideas. It's as if he picked through the rubble of collapsed buildings, collecting a door here and a window frame there and some lumber around back, and then built himself a handsome new house.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Dog Mental, the debut recording by the Andy Biskin Quintet. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the true crime book, The Island of Lost Maps. This is Fresh Air. In The Island of Lost Maps, writer Miles Harvey leads his readers into the world of antiquarian map collecting. If that sounds to you like a flat topic, book critic Maureen Corrigan says that, like Columbus, you're in for a surprise.
True life extreme adventure stories continue to sit atop the bestsellers lists like flags planted on Mount Everest. But this season's newest and hottest extreme adventure tale takes place neither on a mountaintop nor out on a tempest-tossed sea. Rather, most of the action occurs in a library. The Island of Lost Maps by former Outside magazine editor Miles Harvey is an engrossing story concerning the one essential item any thrill-seeker or explorer needs before he or she departs for a far-off place. That is, a map. But as Harvey notes, the maps that he's writing about in his book don't lead to treasure. Rather, they are treasure. The Island of Lost Maps takes readers deep into the strange world of antiquarian maps, a world constructed out of rare book rooms, private collector's studies, and the occasional auction house, places of refinement and dust. Harvey penetrates this world in the role of a detective on the trail of one of the greatest cartographic criminals of all time, a mystery man appropriately named Gilbert Bland Jr. In the 1980s and 90s, as the market for hitherto unregarded old maps began to boom, Bland strolled into the rare book rooms of research libraries across the United States and Canada, requested centuries-old atlases, and when no one was looking, razored out their maps in cold blood. Bland was caught in December of 1995 at the Peabody Institute in Baltimore. A graduate student in history who was sharing the otherwise empty stack room with him on that winter's day noticed his slash-and-dash operation and alerted security. Even then, the Baltimore police were reluctant to arrest Bland, especially after he offered to pay the library in cash on the spot to repair the damaged books. After all, the guy had only stolen a few pieces of paper. When Bland paid the library and left the scene, however, he also left behind a notebook, a virtual shopping list of other libraries whose collections he had desecrated over the past few months. That's when the hunt for Bland began in earnest. Harvey's book follows the by now standard and successful formula for true adventure tales, like, say, Sebastian Junger's A Perfect Storm, which chronicled not only a single disastrous fishing trip in the North Atlantic, but also told us readers all we never knew we wanted to know about commercial sword fishing, search and rescue operations, and near-death drowning experiences. The Island of Lost Maps fans out to give us mini-histories of map stealing and the science of cartography, as well as engrossing individual descriptions of exotic maps and atlases. Harvey sometimes strains too hard after symbolic significance, especially when he tries to fashion Bland into a mirror image of his own shadow self. But mostly, he tells a fascinating and, to book lovers, an ultimately horrifying tale. Security in most rare book collections in the United States has usually been kept to a democratic minimum. Any reader with a valid ID could lay his or her hands on priceless volumes. Although major research libraries have tightened their security, they're reluctant to turn themselves into museums. And so, as one rare book consultant tells Harvey, it's still the case that any halfway smart undergraduate student can pay his way through 4 years at a major university for the price of a razor blade.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Island of Lost Maps by Miles Harvey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer was Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. And from Random House Incorporated Stellacourt Press Division, publisher of The Love They Lost, Living with the Legacy of Our Parents' Divorce by Stephanie Stahl. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, the dilemmas of home health care in the age of managed care. We talk with Carol Levine, director of the United Hospital Fund's Families and Healthcare Project. She cares for her husband, who was left paralyzed after a car crash over 10 years ago. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.